Welcome. I'm Jeremy Hunt, Chairman of Veterans on Duty. We are a policy advocacy organization focused on those policies that make America safe, strong, and free. And we know that starts with having a strong military. And one of those people who served in our military and is really one of the great thinkers, I think, one of the great policy thinkers, is Aaron McClain. And I'm going to interview Aaron McClain, and we're going to talk about his past and when he was a Marine Corps infantry officer during the surge in Afghanistan in 2009. We're going to dig into that. We're going to talk about his hit podcast right now, the School of War podcast. It's really taken off. We're going to talk about all those things. He's now a senior fellow at Hudson Institute. So we're excited. You got to join us. Tune in. Aaron, it's an honor having you here. It really is. So, you barely need an introduction. I mean, you've been in the national security space for quite some time. You are really one of the most foremost policy-minded thinkers, really at the forefront right now. Senior fellow at Hudson Institute, and you host the School of War podcast, which was totally taken off. So we're going to get to that, but I want to first start off your story. Many people that don't know you might not know that you served in Afghanistan. You deployed there as a Marine Corps infantry officer. So take us back through that. Take us, what made you want to serve, and tell us a little bit about your experience.
Yeah. Well, Jeremy, first of all, thanks for doing this. It's great to be here, and thank you for the super kind introduction. I grew up here in the Northern Virginia suburbs. And if you had asked me when I was a kid, what am I going to do with my life? The one thing I would have been able to tell you for sure is that I am never, ever going to join the military. My dad was a career Army officer. I just knew that wasn't for me. Like the short haircut, the getting up early in the morning, none of that really appealed to like 15-year-old Aaron. And then the long story short is 9/11 happened when I was in college, which changed my view of things. The slightly longer version of it is it happened when I was in college. And then if you think back to my senior year of college, I graduated in 2003. In March, we invaded Iraq. And in April, we won. Saddam's statue came down. Like the war was over. And so I'm sitting there still in college, having thought really, really seriously about, you know, joining up in some fashion. And I figured, oh, I missed it. I missed the war. You know, it's like the Gulf War. Like it's over now, and I'm not gonna join the peacetime military. That's just not me. And then the years I went and did some other things, and then the years went on, and it became increasingly apparent that I had missed nothing. And if anything, things were even worse than they were in 2003. So I went to Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in the fall of 2007, and ended up staying in for 7 years, which is much longer than I originally intended.
Amazing. And you went infantry and deployed, I guess it was in 2009 is when you deployed to Afghanistan. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about your experience there. You know, what are anything that surprised you when you were there? What did you learn, and how did that kind of shape your thinking now on a lot of policy issues?
Yeah. I mean, my time in Afghanistan was really my political education. I mean, we all thought we were going to go to Iraq. I thought I was going to go to Iraq. I mean, you joined the Marine Corps in 2007. You think that's probably in your future. My battalion was actually slated for an Iraq deployment in 2009, which was then pulled down because the Marine Corps stopped sending infantry battalions. And then we had this sort of awkward phase in the middle of the year where we weren't really sure what we were going to do. And then President Obama decided to surge troops to Afghanistan. In fact, I remember that West Point speech where he's in December of 2009, where he's speaking to all the cadets, kind of fell asleep. I remember watching it because at that time I was in the company office and our trucks were loaded and going to Cherry Point as he gave the speech. And 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, which was my unit, was the first battalion out as part of that surge. And our objective was this district in Afghanistan called Marja. We fought around the margins of it in January, but then in February of 2010, we went in and took it with another Marine battalion and a bunch of Afghan troops and U.S. Special Operations troops, and then proceeded to attempt to govern it, essentially. And over the course of the next couple of years, so after my battalion's time, obviously, we succeeded in, you know, what in another time you would have said called pacifying the area, where violence really did drop by 2012, 2013. But you asked me what I learned, and here's what I learned. I went there really believing, went to Helmand Province, really believing that we were going to remove the Taliban boot from the neck of the oppressed Afghan farmer who would then rise up and seek, you know, Western-style governance, because that's what all men naturally seek. And the reality was simply very different from that. And I was disabused of those notions. And I found myself, you know, after sort of the initial heavier combat phase, engaged in what were really local politics. Like, that was a big part of my job. And I mean, the combat part continued. It was just smaller scale contacts as compared to the beginning of the deployment.
And key leader engagements, this kind of thing.
Key leader engagements, trying to figure out, you know, what would we have said in the time? Who's who in the zoo, I think, was the expression that was going at the time, and figuring out who you could work with. And in the end, what the Marine Corps figured out was who you could pay. I mean, that's what it came down to, was enrolling a lot of people in systems of, you know, what the Brits would have called systems of tribute and patronage. And that worked, and it continued to work as long as there were American weapons and American money around. And the moment you start turning those off, the moment it stops working.
Yeah, yeah. And so on that, you know, fast forward to 2021 with just the horrible, I mean, botched is honestly an understatement, withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I know you talked quite a bit about that. How was that, watching those scenes of just how, you know, the chaos, and of course the 13 service members who lost their lives there? I mean, how was that for you, having been there, having served there, and the work that you did there, watching that play out in the media?
I think the overall impact is pretty catastrophic, in ways that maybe we don't even fully appreciate yet. I mean, I think you can draw a direct line from that incident to the Russian invasion or reinvasion of Ukraine in 2022, and to, you could draw a line between that and Iranian confidence in backing, you know, the assaults on Israel after October 7th, 2023. I think the Chinese watched that with interest, and we're still seeing how that's going to play out in the Pacific. I also think the effect on a generation of veterans is bad. You go to war and you experience some difficult stuff. And, you know, everyone deals with that in their own way. And this is true of every generation of American veterans. My dad was a World War II veteran. And, you know, with respect to our generation, or I'll just say with respect to my experiences, I mean, he saw a lot more. He fought from the bottom of Italy through to the middle of Italy to France, through France to Germany. And he got to go home when the war was done. But his generation of veterans, I think, in certain respects, had the following advantage, which veterans, say, of Vietnam or now Iraq and Afghanistan don't, which is whatever they saw, they could account for in their minds as part of a necessary march to victory. And it's a lot harder, I think, to process this stuff when you don't have that frame. And I worry, you know, as I remember having a conversation with a very senior military leader about Afghanistan. I remember him telling me, you know, you're a good leader, you're a good officer, you're gonna tell your Marines and the guys you serve with not to worry about, you know, what happens big picture. You know, they did their job, they were good Marines, and that's what matters. And like, on some level that's true, but I remember sitting there thinking, yeah, but you're worried about it, right? Somebody's worried about it. Somebody's thinking about this stuff, right? Because it's got to be somebody's job.
Right, right. Who's looking at the big picture? Yeah, yeah, I'm with you. So speaking of that, so, you know, years later, you end up going and you taught at Annapolis. Is that right? So tell us about that. How long were you there? And then what was that experience like teaching at Annapolis? I'll be honest, this is probably the one and only time I will be highlighting Annapolis, the Naval Academy, on our show here. But go ahead.
It's ironic for me, too, because I went to the hippie liberal arts college that's directly across the street from the Naval Academy, where no one wears shoes. That's why I ended up staying in. Like, I was going to get out. My plan from the start was to do one rotation and then leave. And I was literally sitting in Afghanistan, confident I was getting out, you know, when we got back, and got an email from the battalion executive officer saying, what all you lieutenants want to do on your next rotation. I knew I was getting out. So I thought, you know, what is the most obnoxious, like, ridiculous, over-the-top thing I can ask for? This is a true story. And I emailed the major back within like 30 seconds saying, sir, I'd like to teach at the Naval Academy. Very respectfully, Lieutenant McClain, which you know Marine culture well enough to know that's like borderline disrespectful. Like, you're right on the line with an email like that. To my shock, he wrote me back like 60 seconds later saying, funny you should ask, Lieutenant McClain. The Marine Corps administrative message with available positions has just come out. You seem to meet some of the prerequisites. You should put together a package. So I did, and I actually had, on a personal level, 3 great years at the Academy. I taught in the English department. We just read the books from a point of view of what we could learn about officership and life. And it was really a fantastic 3 years, and I'm in touch with any number of students I had in those days, and colleagues for that matter.
That's awesome. All right, so you know, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up, you have a hit podcast, a School of War podcast. What inspired you to create this podcast, and how has that journey been for you?
The purpose of the podcast is to learn what war teaches. And that obviously can mean a bunch of different things and manifest itself in a bunch of different ways. When we started, I was pretty sure we were going to stick just to history and avoid present-day policy concerns. And then with the invasion of Ukraine, we did a few episodes on sort of the current events side of the war in Ukraine that were very popular. And so that then became the show's brand, a sort of alternation between looking at history and looking at current events and trying to use history to inform my understanding of current events and trying to look at current events with a historical perspective. You know, there's a bunch of different audiences for the show. I think for serving military officers or policy professionals who may be civilians but have some national security responsibilities, it provides a way to, you know, learn about different episodes, events, personalities, to refine your understanding of current events with, the show is really driven by the guests, by like a really impressive cast of guests that we're able to bring in. And I think that audience really benefits from that level of the conversation. I think for the broader audience, you know, I think America has kind of forgotten some things that war has to teach. And the command sergeant major of the Army recently, like in the last few months, was himself on a podcast, and he said something that actually I thought was deeply true and has really stuck with me. He said, I got a lot of soldiers who have a lot of experience of battle, but I have no soldiers who have experience of war. And he's talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, which is a pretty stunning thing to say. Some of the stuff, you know, I was involved in brigade level operations in Afghanistan, it certainly seems pretty warlike, you know. But at a deep level, I think he's right, you know, and I think you got to go back to like literally 1945 to find America engaged in a whole of society struggle for existential stakes. And a variety of factors have kept us out of conflicts like that. And that's obviously a good thing and a streak we want to maintain, which I know is a goal of a group like Vets on Duty. But at the same time, that streak of relative peacefulness, which is relative, like Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, the Gulf War, like these are pretty significant conflicts. Nevertheless, they lead to a kind of forgetfulness about how the world really works. And so the podcast is designed to remind people.
One thing I want to talk to you about, we look at the threat that we're facing right now, and we have the rise of China, and the Chinese Communist Party is no doubt a geopolitical, major geopolitical threat that we have right now. We have Russia obviously invading Ukraine, and then we have Iran, North Korea are still major threats. So we look at the kind of the different people have different takes on it, call the axis, I've heard axis of evil, I've heard axis of aggressors, there's different, you know, whatever you want to call it. But the bottom line is that the threats that we're looking at, the threats that our nation is facing right now are serious. And I wanted to hear from you, what do you think are your biggest concerns for our military as we prepare to deter these types of threats?
Well, a couple things. First, there needs to be a rebuilding of trust between Washington and the troops. The troops need to understand and need to live in a military that is fundamentally focused on deterring or fighting and winning wars. And that needs to be the overriding focus of our military establishment. And the military doesn't have time to be used as a petri dish for social experimentation. It needs to be prepared to fight wars. And the better prepared it is to win wars, the less likely it is we'll have to fight them. Which leads me to my second point, which is all of these threats you outline are real. Conventional wisdom is China is the biggest threat. I happen to share that view. I think China is the biggest threat. Still means the others are out there. And it's easy to imagine very complicated, very dangerous scenarios for our country and our military in the years ahead. And our soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, etc., guardians now, they need to know that they are going to be properly resourced to win these wars. So in addition to their training and their fighting culture, which are extremely important, we need to have the kind of defense budget that realistically supports them in the scenarios that they may face, whether that's one war in the Western Pacific, a war in the Western Pacific plus an additional conflict. I heard someone make the point recently that, you know, at various points in our defense policy history, we've planned for 1.5 wars. Like, I'm not really sure what 1.5 wars looks like. I'm not sure I've ever seen what 1.5 wars is. It was a good point. But we need to get serious. The situation you just outlined is the most dangerous situation the United States has been in since the end of the Cold War. And you could make a case that it's more dangerous than at various points in the Cold War. And at some point, the check may come due here, and we need to be able to pay it. We need to actually show peace through strength.
That's right.
Or achieve peace through strength.
That's right. And one thing that you brought up is the warfighter, the folks who are on the ground, who volunteer to serve their country, we owe it to them to make sure that they have the resources that they need to deter and if necessary, fight and win our nation's wars. What is your message to those warfighters, those soldiers, sailors, Marines, Guardians, as you mentioned, Air Force folks, people who made that decision, looking at all these threats and said, I still want to serve my country. What is your message to them during this time?
Well, in the first place, thank you. It remains an all-volunteer force, and it's very impressive to see young people still throwing their hats in the ring for that. I would also say, I mean, I frequently have conversations with young people. It's not a direct response to your question, but it's worth saying, who tell me they have no interest in joining the military, and I sort of nod and say, okay, well, just keep in mind the way world events are trending, the military may have an interest in you joining them one day. So we forget, we forget that was the norm for a decent chunk of the 20th century for the United States, and we could easily go back to it. Not that anybody wants to, but it's easy to imagine scenarios where we go back to a force that is not relying entirely on volunteers.
Yeah. Could you imagine these days, the young people these days, I mean, it's unfathomable for them to imagine that. And you're exactly right. I mean, I think that memory is, it's so far and distant memory for as a nation, but it could happen again.
The expression back in the day was, well, you're in the Army now. And there's a chance we could be reliving that here at some point in the not too distant future. But to those who are in now, you know, I would, in addition to expressing my gratitude and how much I admire them, I would say that, you won't regret it. You won't regret it, because not only do you get to have the pride that comes from service and having done something selfless, but you will earn a kind of resilience that is not as easy to come by in a lot of civilian walks of life. Like this is a petty example, but it speaks to the broader truth. Like every night when I go to sleep and it's raining outside, and I'm in my bed and there's a roof over my head and I hear the pitter-patter of the rain on the roof, I'm happy. I'm actively happy because I know what it's like to be out there in the field and not have those creature comforts. I lived that for years is my job. That's a pretty minor consideration compared to everything else that, you know, war can involve. And you don't have to go to war. That's just an experience you can have just through military training of building some mild physical toughness and resilience to challenges. But, you know, the military gives you that as an entry benefit. You get to carry it with you for the rest of your life, and stuff like that will absolutely benefit you for the rest of your life spiritually.
Absolutely. So on your podcast, you know, you've had many different guests, and as you said, you kind of mix in history and also current events. You got to tell us, what are some of those episodes that are really memorable to you that you think you'd like to share with us?
Well, I'll give you two examples just from recent weeks. It's hard to pick a favorite, because it's one of the things I'm really proud of about the show is we have very high quality of guests who are expert in all kinds of different dimensions of war. Come through, but you know there was a period just a few weeks ago where we had Stephen Kotkin, who's a historian of Russia, Stalin's biographer, come in and do a just phenomenal analysis of the Trump administration's approach to Ukraine and Russia, laying out the different geopolitical futures that potentially lie ahead depending on what decisions get made. And so at a very, very high level, very, very sort of cutting edge of the discussion, this is what's happening, helping people understand in real time from somebody who is probably better positioned to understand Russia and American options in Eurasia than anyone alive. Like that was one kind of episode. And then just a few days later, I had a historian in to talk about infantry battle in the 18th century and things like War of the Austrian Succession, which sounds so esoteric and niche that you're like, who would actually listen to that? But if you listen to the episode, this historian's point is essentially that the battlefield of the 18th century was a lot more like the battlefield of today than we give it credit for. We think of sort of ranks of colorfully attired troops, you know, marching in lockstep and firing in volleys. And the reality was firepower was already getting to such a point that the battlefield of the 18th century was much, much more lethal than the battlefield of the 17th century. And as a consequence, you're seeing small units develop responses and tactics to that are the start of the story of modern infantry tactics today. So, you know, for the history buff or the professional for that matter, like this seemingly esoteric conversation about, you know, the War of the Polish Succession or whatever, had real, I think, things to teach that are of value. And like, that's what we do with the show. We kind of go back and forth. So I'm proud of that kind of diversity, if you like, in the programming.
Have you had a chance to talk about your experience in Afghanistan? Any of those stories that are really special to you that stick out to you, whether you've been talked about on your podcast or just you want to share with us even now?
Yeah, I've done a couple episodes of on the show with a buddy of mine who I serve with, a guy named O.C. Vest, but less than we probably should have, and I want to do more in the year to come on the post 9/11 wars in general. In terms of my own experiences, I mean, it was a pretty jam-packed 7 months, and I served with some incredible Marines who went through a lot in some difficult circumstances. I guess if there's one moment that, like, of all the moments that will stick with me and that I will never forget, one that you asked me what I learned earlier in our interview here, I was at the T once with a Taliban commander, which seems like a strange thing. You're probably wondering why I didn't arrest him. It's a strange kind of war. This guy owned a lot of land in our area and had declared himself to American authorities when we came into the area and said he wasn't in the local operational chain of command. You can arrest me if you want, but I'm also happy to be a resource for you. And so they let him stay in place. And then I became essentially the cop on the beat down the street from him where he lived with his family. So I would, you know, go check in from time to time, compare notes. You know, we would kind of work over each other with our respective talking points. I remember a day when we were sitting there and he had his 10-year-old-ish son standing there. We were going back and forth. And he had this beautiful, it was like you're back in the British Raj, this like tea garden with like very carefully cut grass and flowers and everything. And this is a deeply impoverished part of the world and a pretty dangerous part of the world. But there was this little oasis kind of in his backyard. I remember, you know, working him over like I typically would, saying things like, you know, the government in Kabul is going to provide security and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he obviously wasn't buying it. And then, you know, referring to his son sitting there, I said, well, look, in 10 years, don't you want your boy to have a university education? Because this guy was very unusual. His dad had been in the Afghan parliament and he had had a university education in Pakistan. Very unusual for this area. Won't you want your boy to have a university education and be a doctor or a lawyer, you know? Have a role in an Afghanistan that has moved past war. And without missing a beat, unblinkingly, he responds, in 10 years, my son will have died fighting in the jihad. And it was in that moment that, like, naive Lieutenant McLean had to, like, recalculate a lot of what he thought were the opportunities here and what he was working with.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you for sharing. You have an interesting take on challenge coins. And for those who watch the show, we know we love to have a moment for our guests to present a challenge coin that means a lot to them and kind of give us a story behind it. But you have a different take.
Am I the only guy who, like, thinks that coins have jumped the shark? I may be the only one.
I even thought
this one I was in. And, you know, you have sort of flag officers walking around with some aide with basically like a backpack full of coins. And you get a coin, and everyone gets a coin, and everyone gets, you know, a wall full of coins. And I don't know, it just seemed like a lot to me. And I've kept a handful that you know, do have some meaningful memory associated with them, but I haven't sort of maintained the collection that I just do. And it's gotten to a point where, like, I've had some absurd experiences with the coins. And here's one story I'll tell you is, and I'm not going to name the country because I don't want to cause a diplomatic incident, but I was on a delegation visiting an American ally. Has many of the same enemies that America does, but has some real internal problems at home and has a bit of a reputation for being pretty tough on internal dissent, we'll just say. And I was at their, you know, essentially State Security, Ministry of the Interior, getting a brief on how they've got all that under control. And, you know, these are bad people that they're dealing with. Nevertheless, this is like the heart of the internal state apparatus for keeping order in this country. And at the end of it, the Ministry of the Interior stands up and gives us all a coin. So I have a coin from the Minister of the Interior. I'm like holding it, thinking, what do I do with this thing? I gave it to my kids in the end. They think it's cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
You know, I'll make kind of a broader observation, if that's okay. So I admire veterans who I know. I'll put you in this category, Jeremy. People who actually seek out forms of public service, whether they run for office, whether they serve in government, whether they try to take what they have learned in the military. I think the military is a powerful teaching tool, not just about strategy and policy, though I think it can be that, but about life. Yeah. And I think we need more veterans in public service. And so folks like yourself, Marines I served with, people like Mike Gallagher or Matt Pottinger, like this whole crew of folks, I think are an impressive lot. And I commend you all for like throwing your hat into the ring, and I admire you guys.
Yeah, well, as you know, our heart at Veterans on Duty, we're building out a national grassroots movement of veterans who care about, you know, these issues, a lot of the policy issues that we even talked about today, and care about our country. And one thing we always say is that our service didn't end when we took off our uniform. We still serve by staying engaged and making sure that America remains safe, strong, and free. And we do that by having a strong military. So I appreciate your contributions to this fight, and you are definitely someone who's continued to serve even after your time in the Marine Corps. I appreciate you, and thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. Here at Veterans on Duty, we are a policy advocacy organization focused on making sure our military is strong, lethal, and focused. All of that, of course, is about making sure America is safe, strong, and free. Those are the values that we hold dear at Vets on Duty, and that's why we're going to be sitting down with different leaders, veterans, policymakers, even some elected officials in our Beyond the Call video series. Stay tuned and join us.